Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast on educational technology from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Bruff, director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this episode, we feature an interview with Ben Rydell Shapiro, a postdoc at the School for Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. I met Ben when he was a graduate student at Vanderbilt, and we had some really great conversations about learning space design. Ben was trained as an architect, and he brought that perspective to his PhD research in Vanderbilt's Space Learning and Mobility Lab, also known as the SLAM Lab, where he combined that architectural perspective with the learning sciences and data visualization to do some really amazing projects visualizing how learning and engagement happens in relation to the physical environment. For instance, if you visit his website, benrydell.com, you'll see some visualizations of families moving through exhibits at Nashville's Country Music Hall of Fame, showing how the family members interact with the exhibits and each other across time and space. It's a fascinating window into place-based learning. Ben is interviewed by my Vanderbilt colleague, Cliff Anderson, Associate University Librarian for Research and Learning. Cliff works at the intersection of a lot of fields too, including library science, theology, and computing, so he was well equipped to discuss Ben's multidisciplinary approach to educational technology.
Well, welcome, Ben, to the Leading Lines podcast. It's really great to have you here.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to be here, Cliff. Yeah.
I'd just like to start off maybe by asking you to introduce yourself to our audience and to say a little bit about your career path to this point.
I started originally from Bay Area, California. I feel like I've traveled all over the place. Went to undergraduate university in Vermont, spent a year abroad in Denmark, ended up in Portland, Oregon after graduating, and then past 5 or 7 years been in Nashville, Tennessee, and now I'm down in Atlanta. So that's kind of the geographic travels I've been on. And then, professionally, I started in architecture. I was really passionate about designing schools. That's why what I pursued is an undergraduate degree. And then always loved teaching, always loved working with educators, and ended up going back to pursue graduate education at Vanderbilt's education school, primarily looking to understand how to design schools better, the physical spaces of schools. And so now I actually found myself, in a field called the learning sciences, which studies learning and teaching and designing new types of environments for learning and teaching in interesting ways. And currently I just started a position at Georgia Tech in the School of Interactive Computing. So I've expanded to thinking about bringing computing and learning and education together, particularly in the design and evaluation of physical learning spaces. So.
Well, I can't wait to ask you more questions about that. Sounds fascinating. But could you tell us a little bit about the lab that you're working in at Vanderbilt? It's called the Space Learning Mobility Lab, and it sounds really unique. What were the kind of problems that you were dealing with there?
Yeah, I think it was a really wonderful place. It connects to a lot of work that's going on at Vanderbilt in education, in digital humanities, and computer science. But the SLAM Lab is really it's led by a few wonderful faculty. Who have been my advisors. One is Rogers Hall, another one is David Owens, a third is Andy Hostetler, and Doug Fisher is another faculty who's recently joined. But it really provides a space for students and faculty and really anyone on or off campus to think about geography, learning, people's movement, and how that's at all relevant to how we design educational technologies and systems. So for me, a lot of the projects coming out of that lab, one was titled Bridging Learning in Urban Extended Spaces. And what we were focusing on was developing all sorts of ways for people to make and take tours of their local city. Other things that came out of that lab, I really love this one study by a former student and now faculty member named Katie Taylor, but she, in summary, had young students design their own bicycles, attend kind of Nashville's bike workshop, and they built their own bikes, and then they were able to move around the city in really, really different ways. And she was showing how they impacted their learning in all sorts of ways. So I think there's some really interesting research coming out of the lab, but primarily for me, it's a wonderful space that just brings different disciplines together to push the bounds of what learning and education can be like for kids, particularly historically marginalized populations, and kind of taking an equity-oriented lens on learning. It's a big thing for the lab, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a great place to do your dissertation. I know the fact that you're talking about, and they are really excellent people to work with, so yeah. I'm envious. But you yourself have been promoting something called interaction geography, and you've shown, I've seen some really great examples, and I wish we could demonstrate them on this podcast, but we'll point people to your website about how that concept can help analyze how people learn in institutional settings, for example, in museums. Can you talk a little bit about what interaction geography is?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think for me, it started obviously with my dissertation, but also an experience. I was in Australia for about 4 months, and they had something called the Building Education Revolution, which was a $16 billion policy to basically put a new building in every middle school and not almost every middle school or remodel buildings. And it resulted in really new physical learning spaces across the country, both schools and in libraries. But it also raised huge questions about, like, why does the physical environment matter for learning? How can we evaluate these spaces? And so for me, that started kind of this trek, this idea of interaction geography is, on one hand, a really new method to interpret, describe, and represent or visualize people's interaction, particularly as they're moving across spaces like classrooms or museum galleries or even urban environments. But it's also a really new approach to kind of start to think about issues in the social sciences, digital humanities, and of course, the field I'm more or less in, learning sciences. So the approach, it brings together a lot of different methods in architecture, in studies of people's interaction and conversation, and also more recently, studies of social media. And what it does is, part of it, again, is a bunch of methods that visualize people's movement, conversation, and social media activity over space and time. And then also developing a lot of ways to interpret these really complex, interactive visualizations, representations, in really new ways to come up with some insights about how we design physical spaces, how we design learning activities that promote better learning for kids in schools or visitors to museum galleries. So that's kind of a large, broad space. And I think this term interaction geography, there's a lot of folks in education talking about the role of space right now. And this is kind of giving a set of methods, giving a lens to think about why those questions are important and how to design educational spaces a bit better to accomplish certain goals for folks.
Yeah, from what I've seen, it's really something that we should all be thinking about in terms of designing a space. It's sort of that classical problem of you design a space, but then there are these beaten paths that don't necessarily follow your design. And you've shown a way to actually expose those and then help people to design better iterations of a learning environment.
Yeah, yeah. That's great to hear, yeah.
So another term that you've used in some of your work is microgeography, and I suppose it's related in some way, but it's also about attending to spatial settings and how that can improve learning outcomes. So what is microgeography?
A big amount of work, as I see it, in whether it's computer science, information visualization, architecture, urban planning, it looks at developing methods to study space and movement, but it does so at like a really large scale, like across cities, or even if we're looking at people's interaction in a museum gallery, it's really just describing where people go at the scale of like a whole gallery space. So for questions about learning and education, that isn't helpful. It's helpful in that you could ask questions about like where and when learning occurs, but you can't really describe, for instance, like social context of learning in any kind of detail. So this term microgeography is very much in contrast to these larger scale perspectives. And so for me, the interaction geography idea is very much giving kind of a more fine-grained look of people's movement, of people's interaction, of space that actually fits kind of education research in a really great way, as I hope. And then I think another thing the term microgeography starts to get at is a lot of people have said we need to study whether it's learning or, you know, controversial policies like New York's stop and frisk program, just related to other work I've pursued. But the point is we need to study these things across scales. So a lot of my work in interaction geography is trying to go across these scales of micro to macro and developing new ways for people to do that. And it's just hard. And collaborating with others, super important to do that. But a real hope is to be able to ask questions at a really small scale and then jump out and kind of revisit those questions at a large scale and vice versa. So
yeah, no, that's really fascinating. And you've done a project that may exemplify some of that model of working at different scales, called the Reshape Project. I've seen this as, if I understand it correctly, it's studying how students live and experience the environment when they're at university, both at the university itself, but beyond and into the city. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think, you know, there's a lot of things that inform this project, the particular project, certainly from the SLAM lab. But, you know, the general idea is of this and of previous work is how can you use people's personal mobility as relevant learning and teaching material in classroom environments? And that came out of Rogers Hall and Katie Taylor's work are two people who've really been pushing that. So what Reshape is it's kind of a computational environment, or, you know, if you want the academic term, it's a computer-supported collaborative learning environment that allows people to go out over the course of a week and collect their physical movement across the city. And then they come back, you know, we've done this a lot in classrooms. They come back and visualize their movement in really dynamic ways in 2D and in 3D over different types of base maps. So we in Nashville, for instance, we use maps that show racial distribution, maps that show the highway system back in the 1960s, the design of the highway system, as well as modern day traffic maps. But the point of it all is that it allows you to look at your movement in really, really different ways and ask questions about very relevant to social studies education. It is a big thing we push. So one thing that learners or people using this environment learn to understand is like how the city, the history of their city, and how, for instance, the traffic system was designed to marginalize certain type of communities by putting highways through certain neighborhoods. On the other hand, it helps people think about the challenges associated with urban planning and design. And so it's in some sense, it provides a way to have really critical conversations without, as I see it, getting upset at each other. It's a really productive way to visualize things in a manner that allows critical conversations to occur that are important to social studies education. And, you know, recently I've been trying to use kind of Reshape as a map-based learning environment to actually teach kids how to program on maps. So kind of using maps and their own personal data to think about how to write code and start to think about computational thinking and programming. So that's new, but that's kind of the mess. So. Yeah.
That'll be fascinating when you're ready to show some of that.
I hope. Yeah, just starting to work on it.
Great topic. So actually, that kind of leads me to your own experience in terms of developing the technology expertise to sort of carry out some of these visualizations. You know, if you go to your website again, there's just these great visualizations that support these projects. But obviously, that takes a lot of investment in code and technology yourself. And so, how did that come about in your own work?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and one I'm really passionate about, increasingly so, and certainly working. There's so many people that are passionate about similar topics as I'll touch on in a second. But I guess for me, it started with maybe my parents way back. My both were software engineers. My dad loved software. My mom hated software. She actually entered it primarily. She always wanted to be a writer. She was all about digital humanities. And so I think growing up in the Bay Area, I watched my mom be successful as a woman in computer science, one of the few women in kind of doing some serious CS work out there, watching her be successful in a way that she never really enjoyed, but she did it kind of for us as kids. And then I watched my dad, who just loved code and loved software and was a great software developer. So I think a lot of those things allowed me throughout my life, but, you know, certainly more recently, to not be afraid to engage in computer science. They certainly empowered me to not be afraid to learn different types of languages and whatnot. So I think learning the program is, as I see it, hugely empowering, and anyone can do it. I really believe strongly in that. People who have, a guy named Mark Guzdile has been really influential on my view of how kids can learn to program and ways to support doing that. But I think a big thing is like what languages allow you to accomplish tasks that you want to accomplish. And I think it leads, for me, a lot of visual-based languages are really powerful. In terms of doing the work that I need to do, and also teaching kids to program. So, that's kind of the the large scale things. I mean, being able to pick up new languages is super important. Not being afraid to engage in programming, talk to others, ask questions, ask good and bad questions so you can improve your programming ability, super important. And I think there are just a ton of emerging communities online and other settings that support that. And I think the processing community is, we may talk about that or not, is a great example of that, but there's plenty more. So
yeah, actually you raised that, you mentioned the language processing, and that's one that I haven't used, but it seems like it's got a lot of pickup from new media and visual artists, and it's a version of Java, but with a focus on visualization and working with images. Can you talk about that? It looks like a really powerful language.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I can use that really to talk about a lot of issues that I just kind of touched the surface on there, but, you know, a few things. I think the processing is to me and to others so much more than a language. I mean, the first and foremost, it's a whole community of people, designers, coders, activists, all sorts of people. Originally started by a few folks named Ben Fry and Casey Reese, and more recently Lauren McCarthy and Dan Schiffman. It originally started with the goal of making programming relevant and accessible to visual artists. But I think it's expanded into much more than that. I think it is a language that can solve a lot of challenges in really relevant ways today. I also think it's really relevant to kids starting to learn to program. So it's part programming language. It's actually a whole development environment with a bunch of tutorials. If you've never heard of it, you know, and you're listening to this, I totally encourage you to go online and just search processing.org. Everything's free. They make everything free and accessible to folks. And they're very much about developing free open source software that allows people to be creators and producers of whatever they want. So I find the people, the ideas, the language is really expressive. It's high level in the sense that it's more abstract. You can write Java code, for those who know what that is, in kind of the processing development environment. It's a great stepping stone into Java. You can do really complicated projects in processing. And then you can also bring in all sorts of libraries and other languages. You can connect with those other types of projects, libraries, and languages. So I find it in some sense, you can do some critiques might say you can't do anything complicated in it. And I would come back and say you can. And it's a great stepping stone for kids learning their first programming language because it gets them into new areas that are really relevant, whether you're a professional software developer or just kind of someone dabbling in it. But yeah, that's kind of I could ramble on a little more. But I just think it's it epitomizes a great language, a great community, and a great set of ideas that are just, I think, relevant to a lot of people beyond just visual artists, you know, and certainly in the academic or community space, I think you can get work done with processing and things like processing. Yeah.
It sounds like it has a great balance between a learning environment and an environment to actually accomplish the tasks that you're after. You know, and I've been working a lot these days in Snap and Scratch and NetSpot. And, you know, I think that's always an issue. Like, you want to teach people computation and how to think about problems that, from a computational perspective, but you also want to give them, you know, the tools they need to solve their practical problems. And sometimes those things don't easily fit together. So processing sounds like a great environment for doing both.
Yeah, that's really well put. Totally agree with that, Cliff. Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, coming back to a topic, you've been studying a lot about the way that people interact in space and learning environments. So I just want to ask you, you know, if you were designing your own ideal university classroom or maybe like a broader environment, what kind of things would you add or what kind of things would you design? What would it look like?
Yeah, boy, I mean,
big,
you know,
question,
how,
I know.
yeah, no, it's a great question. I guess, you know, if there are three things I hear a lot of in terms of themes about how to design these types of environments, one would be make things like classrooms really, really flexible with lots of movable furniture and whatnot. And then a second thing would be, well, take learning and take education and put it, you know, in the city, in environments that people actually live and work in. And then a third is like, well, make it connected to all the online social media technologies that people are using these days. So, I mean, in some sense, some of those aren't all that new. I mean, they've been around for a long time. But I think they represent very different communities. And so I think my perspective is our environments that combine those three types of things. So I still think there's high relevance for having kind of flexible classroom environments that are like locally embedded in communities and like actually connect with the types of technologies students are using in their daily lives. So I think one thing is, you know, the role of the teacher and all that, and the new types of things that have to be expected by the teacher, both in technologies that they can be able to use, but also like how they relate to their students. It's really challenging. So space and teaching, obviously, really interrelated. Can't think about one without the other, I think. And I think a lot of other people think that too. So it's hard to give a, you know, an exact design. You know, but, you know, for instance, a really effective high school that I see that I just got exposed to out in Atlanta is a place called Lab Atlanta. It's really a very new initiative. It's a semester school, but the gist of it, it's basically teaching design thinking, but all out in kind of the context of Atlanta, using Atlanta, so to speak, as a classroom. And I think it's a really inspiring idea in terms of the design of physical spaces. They certainly have a school site and classrooms, but it's very much reaching out into the community and designing, kind of connecting those classrooms and technologies, you know, into the communities that students live in. And it's just, I find that a really powerful way to think about the physical design of classrooms or university campuses or just any kind of space.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. It'd be interesting to learn more about that school. So, you know, as we come to the end of this, of course, this is a podcast on educational technology. So I'm interested, other than processing, what kind of educational technologies do you use when you're teaching? And I guess maybe as a corollary to that, are there educational technologies that you draw on when you're seeking to learn something new for yourself?
Yeah.
That's a big question too. So, you know, but feel free to mention one or two.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, one thing, I mean, I think it's interesting to think about, it's a really great question for a lot of reasons, but one, I think, is that as a teacher, if you are able to program to build curricula or visual-based visualizations, whether you're using processing or you know, Python or whatever, I think it for me, it opens up really exciting and new ways to engage students, communicate content, teach content in really new ways, versus if you're kind of using off-the-shelf technologies, that certainly can be great. But they're two really, really different things. So I think for me in my own teaching, I think there's like a branch of it where I'm using, I'm programming my lessons. I'm building interactive visualizations using data that students collect throughout the course. And I'm using that to teach about education. Or more recently, I'm teaching an ethics course to computer science students. And I'm using that to teach kind of ethical principles to CS students. You know, how would you build, you know, certain types of algorithms, you know, to drive, autonomous vehicles? But then I think there's also, you know, kind of just standard educational technologies that are really helpful. I mean, even a basic one like Georgia Tech recently switched to Canvas. And that's just, it's a real, there's strengths and weaknesses of it, but it's a real game changer with how I can interact with and grade students and other things like that. So also, I mean, worth mentioning, I still think old school technologies like Post-it notes. I even bring Dave Owens taught me this, but I bring a clock or, you know, kind of a timer to class. Really effective way to get students and make lessons kind of move, you know, particularly within an hour or 2 hour period. And when you're teaching, you know, more than 50 or 60 students in a class, the timer is a really helpful way to get people to do things. So, hopefully that was helpful.
No, that's great. You actually anticipate one of the questions that we always ask our guests, which is, you know, what's your favorite analog educational technology? Maybe Post-it notes, unless you have something else, but that's a good one.
Oh yeah, Post-its and the clock, if you can. Yeah, or
the
both.
Clock, the clock. Yeah, I guess the clock depends if it's analog or digital, but fair enough. Right. So, you know, again, are there articles or books you would recommend for people that are sort of interested in the spatial dimensions of learning, things that, you know, if you want to get started thinking about some of the work that you're doing in this area that you say is essential reading?
That's a great question. I mean, certainly visit the Space Learning Mobility Lab website. It's a fairly good start for certain aspects about that. But I think, you know, there are a lot of folks I work with out of, or I know at the University of Washington, that work with a lot of indigenous populations. And so I think when you're getting into this topic of space and geography, there are lots of different perspectives on space. And some are Western, some are non-Western. All are really important. There are really different types of methods to study that. So I think for me, books on time geography, that's like a whole discipline from a man named Torsten Hagerstrand. That was some good readings for me way back. And then in education, I think concepts like place-based education, super important, super interesting to read. And I also find the conversations that are going on in information visualization, computer science, in terms of how to just study and visualize movement or space or geography, super interesting, but really different. So I think in some sense, if you use some of those search terms, the books will come up pretty quickly. And so I think the important thing, at least from my perspective, is to consider these different opinions on kind of these on dimensions of space, also why and how they're relevant to learning. Disciplines have different things to offer. So I have fun.
And I should also mention, you've got a long list of your own publications and works in progress on your website, which is really helpful too for people that are, you know, just thinking about where to get introductions to these topics. And I'm sure that those have great bibliographies as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just getting them out, and I would love feedback and thoughts. I mean, that would be great. And I'll have a few more things coming out. But yes, certainly that the stuff I have up there reviews a lot of these other kind of books and materials out there. So yeah.
And, you know, coming away from this conversation, I'm just really impressed by your ability to sort of synthesize these different disciplines and make something coherent out of it. I mean, you're taking a lot of different perspectives, and then you're able to connect them in ways that actually, you know, advance our understanding of the learning experience in space. So, you know, kudos to that. And I'm just, you've mentioned this a little bit, but, you know, how are you continuing that work and refocusing it in your current postdoc?
Well, let's see. To conclude, I guess, I mean, a big thing for me is kind of scaling up and making available tools that I've built. And so a big thing for me is trying to make these, getting a type of business model that allows these things to be free and open source for other people to use. And you know, I'm working on getting further support to do that. That's a big area. And so I see that being used by educational researchers, these tools, but certainly others, you know, focusing on working with, you know, I've done some work on New York's Stop and Frisk program. And I think a lot of those tools can be useful for studying phenomena like Stop and Frisk and building better community relations, you know, other than kind of just relying on predictive policing software. So I think that's one chunk. And then for me, also developing environments that teach kids computer science, principles of programming is really important and an emerging area. And then a final area that has been really neat to think about with Georgia Tech is to actually think about the intersection of ethics and computer science and using a lot of the research and tools and approaches that I've been developing to teach ethics to computer scientists in a more engaging and immersive manner. So those are kind of the three big areas as I see it over the next couple of years for me. Yeah.
Well, this is fantastic, Ben, and thanks so much for joining us and for this conversation. It's been really informative, and I think your work speaks for itself, so I encourage everyone to visit your website and read some of your papers and sort of interact with your visualizations.
Thanks, Cliff. Yeah, it's hard to talk about them without the visuals. So,
but, it is. It's a little difficult, but you did a great job, so thanks again.
Well, yeah, wonderful to be here, and certainly believe in a lot that the podcast is, everything the podcast is about, so thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Ben Rydell Shapiro, postdoc at the School for Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech, and a proud Vanderbilt PhD alum. Thanks to Cliff Anderson for the interview with Ben. I thought I might add that way back in episode 14 of Leading Lines, we interviewed Kati Berner, professor of information science at Indiana University Bloomington. Kati was on campus with the traveling data visualization exhibit, Places and Spaces, Mapping Science. As part of the exhibit's visit to Vanderbilt, the library organized a student data visualization competition. And who happened to receive first place for best data visualization by a graduate or professional student? None other than Ben Rydell Shapiro. He's always doing really interesting work, and I'm glad we could have him here on the podcast. In the show notes, you'll find a link to that interview with Kati Berner, as well as links to Ben's work, including Vanderbilt's SLAM Lab and processing.org. I really like saying the word SLAM Lab. That's my new favorite acronym. You can find those show notes on our website, leadinglinespod.com, where you'll also find past Leading Lines episodes with full transcripts. We're on Twitter and Facebook too. Just search for Leading Lines Podcast. And if you have a moment to leave us a rating and review on iTunes, that would be great. That helps other people find the podcast. Leading Lines is produced by the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Libraries, and the Associate Provost for Education, Development, and Technologies, John Sloop. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Brough. Thanks for listening.